Thank you. Now, we're going to think for a few moments about this most important question. I'd like you just to imagine for a moment that we have always been in this room. You're going to have to use your imagination. But imagine there are no doors, and you can imagine there's no windows because there are no windows. So there are no doors. We've always been here, and all we do all day is get up and walk around and up and down the stairs, and which doesn't sound very exciting, does it? With all due respect to First Sight, it's a great venue, but not for our whole lives, I don't think. And then one day, someone starts to say very, very loudly, "I want to tell you all that there is absolutely nothing outside these walls. We're all alone, and one day we'll die. We'll die alone." And then, although not quite so loudly, other voices begin to join in and say, "Well, no, I think there is something outside this room. There's another room, and it's full of people like us, except they're happy." And then someone says, no, I think you're both wrong. I think that outside these walls, it is a wide open space, and that there are no walls at all. And there are these little purple people who are trying to communicate with us. And the debate grows, and more voices join in. It goes on and on and on, until eventually someone who sat in the corner puts their hand up and says, "Can we all just stop? It is so confusing. Surely the only way we would ever know is if someone from the outside came in and told us." Now, we live in a society, in a day when there are many, many voices. One of the very loudest today says, "We're all alone in this universe." So Friedrich Nietzsche very famously said, "God is dead." But given the way of men, there may still be caves for thousands of years in which his shadow will be shown. But there are other voices as well. Not just the voice of atheism. There are the voices of Buddhism and Christianity and Islam and Sikhism and countless. I mean, in my study, I've got a book of encyclopedia of religions, and there are hundreds and hundreds of these various spiritualities. So here's an example. You may know of the actress Kate Winslet. She said this: "I'm not an early to bed person, though I'm full of good intentions. It's normally around 1:45. I light a candle and I have a bit of a chat with God or something, though I'm not a religious person." You hear that? So I have a bit of a chat with God or something. It's not clear. It's fairly vague, but it's very spiritual. I wonder if you've ever felt like that person in the corner and just thought, why can't God, if he or she or it or they are there, just come in and tell us and make it clear once and for all? Have you felt like that? Of course, it's not new at all. We just had a reading from the New Testament, from the book of Acts, about the Apostle Paul, who was a first century leader in the Christian church. And during his missionary journeys around the Mediterranean into Europe, he comes to the great city of Athens, which is a city very much like any of our cities today in Western society. Its glory days had passed. Let me just put this up on here. Its glory days had passed, but it still basked in the dawn of those great thinkers and philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle and others. It was still the place where academics met in Athens. It was the heart of commerce and science and politics and media and the arts and, of course, religion. There was the giant gold and ivory statue of Athena that dominated the Parthenon. And all the Greek gods of the pantheon, Apollo and Jupiter and Bacchus and many, many others. So many gods, apparently over 30,000 gods, historians say. And that's why the Roman satirist Petronius wrote down, "Athens is so well stocked with deities to hand, you will easier meet a god than a man." And there Paul spoke about Jesus. And the bit that we didn't read, just before the bit that we read for us, some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers who were the sort of spiritual, philosophical guardians of the city invited him to the place of great debate. We have nothing like it today, called the Areopagus. And I just want you to notice how, we're just going to share a few things with you. Just notice with me what Paul says as he begins to talk to them. He says this, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you." And there's an example of such a stone. Now, perhaps for them there was a God out there who they hadn't yet met. And they were open to that possibility. I don't know if that resonates with you. Perhaps you've come here this evening, you've been invited, and you think, well, I am actually quite open to thinking that there may be spiritual answers to life. I have a Christian friend and I've talked about these things a little bit and I'm curious. I'm at least open enough to see if there is any clarity about this question. It's fantastic that you've come if you are open like that. Because what Paul is saying is, he says, I am the voice in the corner saying, can I please tell you that actually God has stepped into the room and he has made himself absolutely crystal clear. That's the claim on the table this evening. Now, if that is true, it is incredibly exciting, isn't it? You just think about that. That if God has shown himself, nothing can be the same again. Absolutely nothing. And with that clarity comes personal clarity. Who am I? Where is my life heading? What is my life really about, ultimately? Now, the challenge is whether we can keep an open mind to this. Because I think that in our Western society, we're increasingly uncomfortable with anyone who says, this is the truth. Because, I guess because of political situations or others, we're nervous. It sounds arrogant. It sounds fundamentalist. It sounds intolerant and narrow and exclusive and bigoted and all those other ideas. But you know, tolerance has changed in definition. Tolerance used to mean, if you and I have a different view from each other, we can hold those differences and debate and discuss it openly. Increasingly though, please correct me if you think I'm wrong, but increasingly my sense is that tolerance now means that we hold two opposing views, but we are encouraged to assume that they are both equally true and both equally valid, and we're not to debate and discuss, but keep it private. Because there are sensitivities in our increasingly multicultural, multi-faith society. At one level, we understand that. But apart from the nervousness, I think somewhere in there's an assumption. And the assumption is that all religions are all basically the same. Okay, I don't know if you may think that this evening. You may have heard that. Let me just share with you this illustration. Okay, so the illustration goes like this. There is a Raj, a famous Indian Raj, and he invites four blind men into his palace. And I don't know why, it's an illustration, so it doesn't always make sense. There was an elephant in this room. And he invites them to come into the room, because they can't see, they obviously don't know what's there, and they're invited to touch specific parts of the elephant, and one is to touch the leg, and someone else touches the trunk and the flappy ears and the little pointy tail at the back. And they describe in different ways with different language basically the same elephant, you see? And the idea is that all religions are, God is like that elephant. We use different language to describe him, but we're basically talking about the same thing. Do you get the illustration? Now, I heard about two people on an aeroplane who were having this kind of a conversation. And one was a Christian, the other guy wasn't. And the Christian guy said, asked him what he thought. And the other guy said, well, I think there are many, many ways to God. And the other guy said, okay, that's good. And they stopped talking. And then as the plane was coming down to land, it entered a storm, quite a violent storm. And there's a lot of turbulence and the passengers were getting pretty nervous and seatbelts were tightened very tightly. And he tapped this guy on the shoulder and he said, what? He said, I just want to say I'm glad the pilot doesn't share your philosophy. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, because out there in that storm and through the thunder and the lightning is a control tower. And there's a voice coming through saying, 10 degrees east, steady, steady, 10 degrees west, hold your course, well done. I'm glad the pilot isn't saying, there are many ways into the airport. There are many ways. Sometimes there's only one way, and if it can be demonstrated respectfully, objectively, then why would we be nervous of that? Also, to say that we are touching the same elephant, the same God, if you think about it, it assumes that we have a vantage point that those blind people don't have. We can see the whole elephant, but by definition, nobody can see the whole, because that would be an absolute statement. So we end up making an absolute claim, which is the very thing we're not supposed to do in the first place. Can you see that? So there's a kind of logical contradiction about the idea, the assumption. Now, I'm not saying this to poke fun at people who have that conviction at all. What I'm trying to encourage you to do is to have an open mind. Because Acts 17, I think, gives us a very fresh and coherent and quite challenging perspective on this whole question. Can we be clear about God? So I may tread, or it may tread, on some of our sensitive toes about this, our cultural sensitivities. They may be tender, but I want to encourage you to persevere with me, okay? So we're just going to have a look at three perspectives. Here's the first one that we... Ben told me to stop pointing this at the screen. I'm still doing it. So here we go. Here's our first thing that Paul just wants us to think about. God made us. We didn't make him. Okay? The verse is up there. If you can just see the number 24 at the top. And just let me just read this to us. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by hands. That is really quite interesting, isn't it? That is really quite interesting. So, the most sophisticated, architecturally stunning building, religious site, may be magnificent, but Paul says you won't find God there. You won't find him in a cathedral. You won't find him in a church, a shrine, a temple, a mosque. You won't find him anywhere like that. You won't find God living in a religious artifact. You won't find him in a painting. You won't find him in a statue. You won't find him in a medallion around your neck. You won't find him in a magic stone. You won't find him in any of those places. He doesn't even live in bread. You heard me right. In 2010, I don't know if you remember the story of David Howlett, who went to his local curry house in Surrey and was convinced that he saw Jesus in his naan bread. Do you remember that? But God wasn't there. And look what he says also in verse 25, the next line down. And he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life, breath, and everything else. So I think in India in 1995, there was quite a storm because there was a claim that one of the Hindu gods, Ganesha, was drinking milk. The statue was drinking milk that was left as an offering to it. And people got very excited, and folk from around the world, media gathered, until it was demonstrated that it was actually capillary action causing the milk to soak up into the stone. See, God doesn't need anything from us, is what Paul is saying. He is far bigger than we ever imagine him to be. He is not that tree, he's not that sky, he's not the universe as pantheism teaches us. He is the Lord of heaven and earth. That's what Paul says. Can you see that? And therefore, this God lives outside of everything that he has created. And he never had a beginning. He's the uncreated God. And he made the world for us to live in, not the other way around. And he feeds us. Not Sainsbury's, although it might be via Sainsbury's and via the farmers. But he sends the rain and seasons that we need. You know, one of the really weird things about having a name like mine is that, I mentioned this last night, people always mix me up. Well, not always, often mix me up. So I get letters saying Miss Ayla Gage and Mrs. Ayla Gage, and on the phone someone says, oh, I thought you'd be a lady, but here I am. Now, it may sound strange, but is it possible that we've started in completely the wrong place when we come to think about God? I don't know if you know anything about the 19th century German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach, and he said that religion is man attributing to God his own highest feelings and thoughts and ideals. So what Paul is saying is that the reason we're confused is because we project onto God what we like to think God is like, rather than letting God speak to us and show us what he's really like. Now here's the question. Surely, if God made us, it would be crystal clear. We wouldn't be confused. It would be obvious, don't you think, if God made us? Well, we're going to look now at the second perspective that Paul just gives us. There we go. Brilliant. God's not far from us, or we are far from him. So, verse 26, and Paul says this, from one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the times set for them, the exact places where they should live. Now, I don't know if you ever saw the BBC series, Who Do You Think You Are? Remember that series? And I think there's a guy who came to culture, an actor, I can't remember his name now. Peter Havers or somebody? Even Nigel, there we go. So I'm getting names wrong. Nigel have a say. And people are increasingly interested in their roots, aren't they? Where have we come from? Who are my ancestors? How has that shaped the person that I am today? We seek those connections. And what Paul is doing, he's giving us the most mind-blowing connection. He's saying that your life, the story, your private story of who you are and where you began and where you're going, isn't just this little private bubble in which you float along in. It is actually connected to a far greater story, a far greater reality. That the God who made us had a plan from the start. He started with one man and he populated the earth. And he set the boundaries and the times of where we're going to live. So I don't know if you've ever done this. I don't know if you've ever thought, well, why wasn't I here when I used to see Boudicca die in 61 AD? Well, why wasn't I around to see the death of Da Vinci in 1519? Why are we alive now in 2014? Well, you might think, well, it's just chance. But what Paul is saying is that God planned it. But why? Can you see on the screen verse 27 at the top? Paul says this. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. You see, that is really quite an amazing thought, isn't it? That God never intended us to live this life confused. So we're stuck in this room and we don't really understand what's outside. He made us instead to seek and to find because he is close. And that is a profoundly deep and beautiful truth. So just think for a moment of someone that you love very dearly. And if you could weigh the bonds that exist between you that hold you together, there'd probably be no weight scale in the world that would take it. You'd be so overcome by just the joy of knowing someone intimately and lovingly. And the Bible says, well, that is a gift from God. But far more importantly, he made you and I, men and women in his image, for a far stronger and deeper bond, to know him, the God who is personal and who loves us. And it is a privilege, says Paul, that we cannot escape. So if you just look down there at verse, sorry, it's down at the bottom, by the way, but hopefully you can see that, verse 28. For in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. So Paul knows the literature of Athens, and he says, look, some of your own poets, Epimenides and Aratus, the Sicilian, had the sense that they somehow were connected relationally to God. And they called him Zeus, and that wasn't right, but they had this sense that they were meant for something bigger and deeper. And I think that is still true today. Well, it must still be true today. An illustration of that is, you know the singer Sting? Always having to make kind of cultural calls and use these illustrations. But Sting wrote a song. He didn't write a book. He wrote a song called Oh My God. And he said this, everyone I know is lonely, and God is so far away, and my heart belongs to no one, and so I sometimes pray, please take the space between us and fill it up some way. See that? Is there a God? I've got the sense that maybe there's more. But here's the question. Why does God seem so far? If he is close, why does he see so far? He's not a God who is in deism, which is a God who just starts the world spinning like a, you know, like a little, what are they called? Spinning thing. brilliant. And head teacher, there you go. And they said, well, actually, I don't really want to be involved in that. I'm going to go away for a while. It's not like that, says Paul. And the clue really is verse 29. Let me just read that for you. I don't put it on the screen. Therefore, since we're God's offspring, we should not think that the divine beings like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. So in other words, God is not far from us, but we are from him. And for some reason, says Paul, we use our God-given creativity and imagination to make other gods that the Bible calls idols or counterfeit gods. And the room, Paul says, is absolutely full of them. So here's a really fascinating the quote from an American secular writer called David Foster Wallace. He said these words, and I've just missed some little bits, just for length, but the theme is the same. And he spoke this at a commencement address not long before he very sadly took his own life. And this is what he said. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap real meaning of life, then you'll never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. Worship your intellect. You will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. See? It's quite interesting. Not a Christian, but he says we are all worshippers of something. And really, I think that's how the Bible explains this idol. An idol is anything that we look for ultimate significance or ultimate security or ultimate significance. So it could well be my career or a family member or romance or children or some political cause or human approval or comfort or money. And those things are so very precious to us, aren't they? If you just think, if this was taken out of my life, what thing, if it was taken out of your life, would mean your life would potentially fall apart? And that is the idol, if it is not God. You see that? And they are not wrong things. They are not wrong things, but they were never intended to give us ultimate security and ultimate satisfaction and meaning. And because they don't last. Sickness, I'm a minister. I've taken many funerals in my time. I've seen a lot of sick people. I've seen a lot of it in my family. And all kinds of things happen. Sicknesses spoil promising futures. Relationships break down. Children leave home. Careers end. The people we love die. We get bad news. We face depression. Nothing created can ultimately give what only our Creator can. But why are we like this? We haven't got to the heart of it. Why are we like this? And here is the saddest irony. In a very tolerant and a very broad society that we are, there is something we really struggle to tolerate. Just hear me very carefully here. And it's this. And it's been like this ever since the beginning, says the Bible. That we find it really hard to be told by God who he is and how he says we should live our lives. We find that difficult naturally. So someone once said to me, not too many weeks ago, very angrily, he said, why did God make me? Am I a dog? That he should just click my fingers and I come running to him, wagging my tail? Who does he think he is? And I've got to confess that is how I lived for 21 years of my life. Who does God think he is? It's my life. I'll do exactly what I want with my life, on my terms. And I even at times thought I could perhaps carve out God into something that was more comfortable for me to live with. A God who I could cry to when I was in trouble but ignore when things were going well. A God who would never challenge me and wasn't judgmental. And right at the heart of it, you see, right at the heart, the Bible says, is that we will not give God his due and will not tolerate who he is. Now I know that's hard to hear. I know it's hard. But the question is, can it be right to treat the greatest being in the universe like that? Can God really tolerate that, ultimately? And that's why we must now we'll rush on to our last perspective that I just want to share with you. And it's this, that God is patient, but he set a final day because of Jesus. And that should have come up on there. Let me just read to you. Are you still with me? Let me just read verse 30 there for us. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, for he set a day when he'll judge the world with justice by the man he's appointed. He's given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. Well, one of the very greatest qualities of God is that he's patient. He's patient. Day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute, he gives us time. He gives us time to turn around and turn back to the God he made us, to admit our mistakes and to ask for his forgiveness. But we might think, well, why should I do that? Why should I do that? Surely all you're really saying tonight is that this is just another idea in the room. We're still in the room. This is only your opinion. Well, the answer to that is no, because God has stepped into the room in his son Jesus. And he's got a plan. I've just read that in verse 31. When a day when time will come to an end and history will come to an end, and each one of us will have to stand before him a day of justice and give an account for how we've lived our lives and however many years he gives us on this planet. And he's proved it. He's proved it by raising his son from the dead. Now that is the most astonishing claim of the Bible, is that Jesus isn't just another voice, isn't just another prophet, it isn't a moral guide. His true identity is that he is the Son of God. It's really fascinating, this. You know, in the world religions, the leaders of those religions usually are prophets who say, let me show you how you can find God. Jesus comes and says, I am God, and I've come to find you. He said, that's radically different. But can Jesus actually, does Jesus really have that perspective? Can he see the whole elephant, as it were? Is he really in a position to say such an outrageous thing? It's either the height of arrogance and intolerance, or it is stunningly, beautifully true. Which is it? It can't be anything else. It's either true or it's false. He can't be anything in between. Does he have the vantage point? Well, tonight is really just moving us on towards later in the week, and I would love you to come back, particularly on, well, each evening, but Thursday and Friday we're going to be looking particularly at a bit more at what Jesus came to do. But let me just give you some highlights now. Think of his character, his godlike character. No matter how hard you look at Jesus, and I don't know if you've ever read anything about him, we can't find anything that he ever did wrong. He is everything that I would like to be, but I'm not. He is perfect humanity. And he had unique power and compassion. So he touched a man who was socially ostracized with leprosy and healed him. He healed a lady who'd been bleeding for 12 years and was also socially marginalized, and restored her. And he showed great consistency. He said we should pray for our enemies and for those who persecute them. And on the cross, as he died, he prayed, Father, forgive them, because they do not know what they're doing. Bertrand Russell, who was absolutely no friend of Christianity, said, if we were all like Jesus, this world would be paradise. Isn't that interesting? There is enough in Jesus, a man, for us to love him, but he made extraordinary claims as well. So as he taught, people flocked to him to listen. He wasn't like any of the teachers around him who came before him. It was fresh. It was fresh, and he had authority. And his claims were extraordinary. He said things like that he could forgive sin. He said, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And the religious establishment heard that. They heard his claim that he was God on earth, and they couldn't tolerate it. They could not tolerate it. And so they had him unjustly arrested and tried and murdered. And the irony is that Jesus' claim was proved to be true by what happened after his death, his resurrection. He repeatedly said, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to die, I'm going to rise again on the third day. And he did. And he was seen. He was seen by eyewitnesses. He was seen by groups of 500 people over a period of 40 days. Then the historic resurrection of Jesus Christ vindicates his claim and sets him head and shoulders above everybody else. The evidence is right there. And we're going to unpack that a bit more, particularly on Thursday and Friday. But here's the good news, you see. I mentioned last night that Philip Pullman The author, most unlikely person to say this, said that thou shalt not is easily forgotten, but once upon a time lasts forever. And you see, if we think that God is all about thou shalt not, well, he does give us his commands. But he does it, like I said last night, in the context of a story. And the most amazing climax to the most amazing story of all, of which our lives are somehow connected, is the death of his son, Jesus. Because as Jesus was dying on the cross, it was not a sad mistake. It was actually the heartbeat of God's plan. Because as he died there, God was working out his justice that should fall on me, Ayla Gage, but fell on his son, Jesus, willingly, sacrificially in my place. And he did it for me. He did it for me and he did it for you. The question is, why did he do it? Why did he do it? Because although we can't tolerate him, he comes to us in great humility and he gives up his life for us. And so that we can be freed from our guilt and we can be made clean and come home to the God who made us. Have you ever met a God who is like that? Do any of the world religions present a God who comes to us like that and makes so much sense of our lives? I had a story, I'm going to finish now, but I had a story of forgive me if some of you have heard this, of a girl who ran away from home when she was quite young. And she fell into very bad company in the city. And her parents were very worried about her. And her mother came into the city to see if she could find her daughter. She's convinced that she'd find her somewhere. She looked day and night for a long time. And soon it became evident she just couldn't find her. The family needed her and she had to get home. She decided the only thing she could do, desperate, was to take a photograph of herself and to write a message on the back and photocopy it time and time again and go and put it up in every bar and club and cafe that she could find. The message simply read, "Wherever you are, whatever you've done, come home." And she left the city and went away. One night her daughter walked into this club and she saw a picture of her mother on the wall. And she took it down and she read on the back and it said, "Wherever you are, whatever you've done, come home." And a couple of hours later, she was in her mother's arms. Now, if we think that is a beautiful story, that is nothing compared to what God has done. He's left a message for us, written in his blood. Whoever we are, whatever we've done, will we come home? Will we come home? And as I finish, I want to thank you so much just for listening. And I know there's a lot to take in. But I want to ask you to just think about two things as I close. And the first one is this. Can you ask yourself, is your mind open to considering this Jesus? If he really is the Son of God, then it would be a great tragedy to walk through your life and to have ignored him all the time, wouldn't it? That's one thing. So I'd encourage you to come back. Come back tomorrow. Come back this week. Think about it. Talk to a friend who's brought you. There's nothing more important. And the last thing I just want to ask you to do is to accept that little gospel that you had. I'm sorry we didn't read from it, but I thought Acts 17 might be more helpful this evening. Why don't you just accept that as a gift and take it and read it? Because if you do, you'll find the most tolerant, profoundly beautiful and important person who has ever walked the face of this planet, Jesus Christ. And you see, God has walked into the room and he has made himself crystal clear. Thank you very much for listening. And if you want to chat afterwards, I'll be very, very happy to do that. But thank you for listening. I appreciate your time. Thank you.